This is Seattle's Morning News. You've heard about Huawei, the giant Chinese tech manufacturer. There are allegations that it has actually been helping the Chinese government with some of its surveillance programs. And Eva Doe writes about this in the Washington Post. Eva, is it considered unusual that a Chinese company would be helping the government? Because as far as I know, doesn't the government pretty much have its hooks into every, quote, private company in China?
Yes. So for years, this is what people have presumed has been going on, because according to Chinese law, companies like Huawei, technology companies, do have to assist the government when requested for investigations. And so what is new now is the level of documentation in these PowerPoint slides that shows Huawei does, in fact, know to a pretty detailed level how its technology is being used for surveillance by the government, which for years before, Huawei's official line was that it did not know. It just sold its equipment to customers and then didn't know what happened after that.
I see. So they were saying we basically can't help it if the Chinese government wants to use this technology for surveillance. We're talking about some pretty sophisticated stuff, like tracking voice prints and image recognition. And you're saying that they deliberately pitched these technologies for use in government surveillance?
Yes. So these were marketing PowerPoint presentations that were showcasing the features of these technologies. And for some of them, like voice print recognition, it says that it's for national security purposes. So it is pretty clear who the intended customers are for this technology.
And did you also find, for example, one of the things this is being used for is to control the Uyghur population, as I understand it, on the grounds that they're a dangerous group of people. And Huawei expressly designed technologies to make it easier to do this?
So they have these police tracking systems, facial recognition systems that are aimed for use by police. And in some of the slides, they do say that they have been put in use by the police in the Xinjiang region, where the Uyghur ethnic minority is native. So and publicly before, Huawei has been saying that, yes, some of its technology does get sold eventually to Xinjiang, but they say it is through other companies, that they are selling to companies that sell to others, and they don't really know or track where that technology ends up or what it does. But what these slides are showing are they indeed know where the technology is going and how it's mm-hmm. used.
So what do we do with this information? Because I think we've known ever since the tech revolution that the technology can be used either for noble purposes or for nefarious purposes based on who gets their hands on it. So is it fair to say that even if Huawei had not specifically pitched these technologies to the government for its use in surveillance, that the government would have figured that out anyway, eventually, wouldn't it?
Yeah. People are saying, hold on a sec, like, what exactly are these technologies doing and what are the societal consequences of them? A lot of them, like facial recognition, have just developed so quickly that regulation hasn't caught up. In many countries, including the U.S., there is not yet really regulation of them or a good understanding of the consequences of this being used pervasively. And so, yeah, in China also, you're seeing the government start to express concerns about widespread use of facial recognition. In the U.S. too, Facebook has announced that it's deleting 1 billion facial scans of people. Hmm. So yeah, with major companies like Huawei, like Facebook, there is like a vigorous discussion going on about what kind of technologies they should be producing and how they should be used.
It's not just government, right? Because corporations would be tempted to use this to make sure people are paying attention at work, show up when they say they'll show up, track their movements throughout a factory, for example. I mean, you could use it for anything.
Yes, exactly. So some of these technologies Huawei was marketing to the government, and some of them they were marketing for corporate use, for companies to be able to track their employees or track their customers.
And there's another issue with Huawei, and that is, should Western countries be purchasing their technology, or could it be that if you do that, given again that it's a company that is controlled at least in part by the government, Could they have installed some kind of backdoor technology that would allow China to spy on any equipment built by that company?
Yeah, well, telecommunications gear is it's critical. It's what all our information flows through, like phone calls, internet data. And so it is very hard for any company to guarantee that there would not be any vulnerabilities to their equipment. And not only that, in many countries, including in China, companies are required under law to assist in national security investigations. Right. And so, yeah, it is a real consideration for each country's government of, you know, what kind of equipment they choose to use and what kind of potential vulnerabilities there would be.
Of course, we all have cell phones in our pocket, and none of us knows how they really work or what's inside those things. So whose job is it to figure out whether we are being watched or not? In your work, you know, who do I call if I think I'm being watched? Is there anybody?
Oh, well, that's quite a tricky question because, yeah, as you point out, with smartphones and these kind of technologies, there's so many ways that we're being tracked and can be tracked. I think a large part of the responsibility is in governments to have, you know, reasonable and effective regulations for these technologies. Because a lot of it, it's just too complicated to expect your average consumer to be researching by themselves. You really need experts to be looking at these questions. And in fact, in the U.S., we have been seeing major tech companies like Microsoft, Amazon, saying that they are looking to wait for federal regulation to be in place, that they're uncomfortable just deploying these technologies until there is further research from some experts in the government about what kind of limits there should be.
Well, personally, I think there should be a golden rule. I know we can't control the progress of technology anymore, but the rule should be if my phone is tracking me, then I should be able to track whoever is tracking me. If I can track me, if you can track me, then I should be able to track you back, and then we can sort of check on each other. But I want to know who's tracking me if they're going to track me.
I think that the level of surveillance would go down a lot if that kind of rule was in place.
Wouldn't it, though? The story is called Documents Link Huawei to China's Surveillance Programs, written by Eva Doe of The Washington Post. Eva, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Choke Point.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. It's been a year of projects delivered and projects delayed, and Chris has some of the highlights and the lowlights.
And one of the lowlights, of course, is the fact that I wish I had some better news for the people stuck in West Seattle, because the High Bridge is going to be closed until the middle of next year under the current schedule. That's going to make it more than 2 years since it was closed down for the cracking concrete. Repairs are underway right now. The contract expires at the end of June, and it'll be into July before the bridge actually reopens. They've got a couple of weeks of testing they've got to do to make sure that the fix is good to go. So that's what we're looking at for the West Seattle
and
Bridge.
And so how solid is that timetable?
They think it's pretty solid because they saw good work out of, because it's basically an extension of what they've already done on the shoring up process of adding post-tensioning steel and things like that. So and carbon fiber wrapping. So they know that that works. So they believe that they can get this thing done, barring, of course, another giant COVID shutdown or a huge supply chain problem, which could shouldn't compact this one so much, or like the concrete strike. There's a local strike involving concrete delivery, and so we're seeing some problems with that. But this should be pretty solid. They've been with this timeline for about a year now, and they're pretty confident they can get that done.
So who gets to be the first person to drive a test load across the bridge?
Again, that'll be city employees, city engineers, things like that, part of the testing crew. I would love to do it. I guess one of the best, one of the funnest things I did this year was getting inside that thing.
I remember that.
That was a lot of fun. getting inside the center span and looking down and trying to spit through the hole to get all the way down 140 feet to the Duwamish River. Okay, so, I didn't do that, but I thought about it.
and so when they open it, it will be equipped with the same instrumentation that detected the crack, so you'll have real-time monitoring of any further cracking that may happen.
Yeah, and they're on top of that. And since they've added the carbon fiber wrapping in the spots where the cracking has happened and the post-tensioning where the cracking has stopped, so they've seen success with what they've done so far. So
I'm just trying to figure out whether I'm going to use it or not.
Oh, trust me, you know, when you get the chance, and many people living in West Seattle, they're going to be on that thing in droves right now. And the plan is to open it right away to everything, not a phased opening to test it as they go. The plan is to go straight away with it. So we'll see how that goes. That's the timeline. And boy, I feel for those folks in West Seattle because, as you know, it's so hard to get in and out of there.
A few times, again, I mean, I go over there quite a bit, and sometimes we know some people up on the north end of West Seattle trying to get back. I've tried to do it like 3 or 4 times now, and the map never sends me the same way. I told you about the time I ended up in the bus lane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, what do you do there? The city's trying, they've done a bunch of mitigation stuff, but you can only change the signal timing. You can only add so many left turn pockets or speed humps in neighborhoods to keep people from flying through. So, that's what's going on there. And another story that, I get asked about this all the time. Oh, wait a minute. I'll get to that in a minute. Let's start with the Tacoma area drivers, who were expecting to get the I-5 back after more than 20 years of construction, but the promise to finish the HOV and widening project at the end of this year was not kept. Supply chain issues, though, and those darn atmospheric rivers put those plans on hold. So the Washington Department of Transportation's Kara Mitchell had to break us the news.
The contractor had a very ambitious goal. When they realized that they weren't going to be able to make it, then we thought, okay, we need to come clean and rip the Band-Aid off and tell folks we've got a few more months of this.
Summer of 2022 is all Mitchell will promise now going forward for when they're going to open up that project. That, I think, will make a big deal. Those direct HOV access ramps prevent a lot of weaving and merging around 16. So that'll be a project I think we're going to highlight next year as something positive for the region. Now, I-5 southbound drivers in the Seattle area are still asking me to this day, when are those horrible bumps on the freeway going to be fixed?
Yes.
I mean, you know it. I mean, the Revive I-5 project did a lot of paving this year between the convention center and the West Seattle Bridge. But as we know, the workers didn't get to all the expansion joints. They only replaced 6 of 40. And that has left 37 jostling bumps as you head out of downtown. I just drove it again last week. They're horrible.
So now, you counted them?
No, yes, of course. You have to, because I've been counting just the life of my shocks that are going away on my cars. WashDOT tried to grind the bumps down, but drivers, of course, still don't like them. WashDOT's Tom Pierce, again, on why they decided to pave before replacing the joints.
It's a more efficient process to repave and then replace the expansion joints because it's just easier to match the expansion joint height to the pavement rather than match the pavement to the expansion joint height.
Well, there's your explanation, but that's going to leave us with a bunch of bouncing until the dry weather returns next year. Now, of course, it wasn't all bad news this year in transportation. Sound Transit opened up its light rail station in Northgate. Of course, 2 months later, a train slammed to a stop in the UW tunnel when the main power cable came apart. How that happened, still under investigation. The Fairview Bridge outside of South Lake Union, just down the street, reopened after 2 years of construction. New bridge has plenty of room for cars and bikes. Also a great spot to take a picture of the lake and the things going on there if you're looking at that. Amtrak trains returned to the Point Defiance bypass route nearly 4 years after that deadly derailment. The new I-5 HOV lanes, freeway off-ramps, and construction through JBLM opened up this year. That's made a big improvement through that area, though there was plenty of work left to do. There's a new Good2Go website. Users seem to like it. There's a new WashDOT website. Yeah, drivers aren't exactly sure whether or not they like it, but of course, change is difficult. And just quickly, Peter Rogoff heading out as the CEO of Sound Transit. He's going to stay on until they get a new guy. And incoming Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell just fired Transportation Director Sam Zimbabwe.
What?
Sam Zimbabwe. That happened Friday afternoon. We got like a late note going, thank you for your work and good luck in your future endeavors. So without ceremony, without any real explanation,
that?
We don't know. That I've been trying to find out because, I mean, other than some baggage he came in in with that that people kind of hit him up on.
Yeah.
He seems to have done a pretty decent job kind of spiriting the area through the West Seattle Bridge closure. I know a lot of people think it could have been done faster. I think he's been pretty transparent in that. But yeah, that one kind of surprised me. I guess everybody wants their own people to do their own thing. But I think Sam's done an okay job. I mean, he's a huge improvement over Scott Kubley, who should never have been in that job in the first place because he really was over his head. But I thought Sam did an okay job. I'll be waiting to see what Bruce says about why he made that decision going forward. Maybe there's, you know, philosophical differences or things like that. But yeah, that one happened just on Friday afternoon. Hannah Scott just texted me. She's like, did you just see what happened? I'm like, oh my gosh. And then I got the note. So yeah, so some changes at the top of some very important agencies around our region. Yeah. So we'll see.
And I saw some helpful lane changes in downtown Seattle too. The that on-ramp by the fitness center. What's that? Down by Boren. It's the shortcut I take home. Anyway,
oh.
they helpfully put a big I-5. They painted the I-5 marker right into the road.
On the street, right.
On the street.
So you know where you're
finally
supposed to be going. Yeah.
And the same thing with getting back from West Seattle. You know, when everybody has to take Michigan now
right
to get back on the ramp there and trying to figure out where do I, which lane am I allowed to use. They finally just put a big fat I-5 on the road that you couldn't miss. And I appreciate that.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's important. Oh, another thing that they're doing, by the way, they have started work on widening I-5 through Seneca as well. That project has started just slowly but surely. So over the next year or so, they're going to be widening that to give us that.
And then they put the ramp meter on the I-90
merge. Oh, have they already added it?
No, I'm asking
you. Oh, no, good.
You.
That hasn't happened yet. I was like, how did that happen without me knowing?
No,
but that's going to be happening.
I'm waiting to see what the reaction of that's going
to be. Yeah, because, I mean, most people don't really. They're like, it's a freeway to freeway.
Exactly.
But to the Department of Transportation, that's a ramp. So, yeah, so we'll see. When those ramp meters go up there right at I-90 through the CD lanes, I think there are going to be a bunch of people going, why wasn't I listening to Cairo Radio for the last 5 years when Chris was telling me that these things were coming? Because I've been telling you for that long. You should be ready.
And that will be the one traffic light between Seattle and Boston. Historic.
Well, that is true, considering I drive through Wallace now in Idaho. That was the last place where there actually was a stop sign before they moved the freeway out of downtown. See, all the things I'm learning about obscure places in Idaho and Montana as I'm driving, it's made me a better traffic reporter, I believe.
Time for Crime and Punishment. Street races, shootings, overdoses, resentencing, handling the massive backlog. Kara's Hannah Scott has the King County Prosecutor's final report for 2021 and a look at some of what's ahead for the office in 2022.
Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, we've all seen a lot of change. The pandemic has taken a toll on everything in one way or another, including public safety. And with all of the rhetoric on that issue and the genuine public need, the King County Prosecutor's Office took action to give all of us the ability to cut through the noise.
Launch a public data dashboard that gives the public insight into our work. This is one step that we took to let folks know how we're working to keep them safe and hold folks accountable.
Douglas Wagner with the King County Prosecutor's Office says the dashboard put all the answers right at our fingertips.
This is a way to kind of peel back the veil and let folks see for themselves the number of cases that law enforcement send to us in the form of investigations, how many of those were charging or how many of them, you know, were declining because they don't meet our standards. Importantly, it also kind of leads us to number two on the highlight, this really historic backlog.
The backlog existed prior to the pandemic, but no in-person trials for more than a year due to COVID exacerbated that problem.
This past year in King County, we took steps to reduce that backlog.
And that eventually paid off in the form of more staff to help start closing some of those cases. The pandemic also saw increases in the number of hate crimes being reported.
A group of deputy prosecutors in the criminal division got together and formed a hate crime outreach team. That was something that they did voluntarily. It's not an official part of their work, but they got together, saw that hate crimes were up in our community and that it was really important that we as the prosecutor's office started to get out with these presentations to both law enforcement and community groups to help explain what qualifies as a hate crime, what doesn't, and how folks can go about reporting them. And so we had 53 filed hate crime charges this year.
One major milestone for the prosecutor's office.
Prosecutor Satterberg in February testified in support of Senate Bill 5164, which requires prosecutors to resentence individuals who are serving a three strikes life sentence that's predicated on a second-degree robbery charge. We know that second-degree robbery was the lowest on the list of potential three strikes offenses. It was also the most racially disproportionate. And there were roughly 20 people in King County who are serving a life sentence based on a second-degree robbery three strike, but they no longer should be, because in the previous years, the legislature had removed second-degree robbery as a three-strikes offense.
A milestone they're particularly proud of at the prosecutor's office.
We, for the third year in a row, diverted more juvenile cases than we filed through the court system. We're now at a historic low of 22 kids who are in secure detention, and that's compared to 205 in the year 2000. It's just really great to see that the juvenile justice system is continuing to move in the right direction.
But not everyone agrees with that no-youth jail philosophy and want to know what metrics there are to show them that this method actually works to keep young people out of trouble and the public safe.
There's a study from 2014 that showed that the young people that went through Choose 180's programs were less likely to commit another crime than the youth who went through the traditional court and detention system.
One of the more unfortunate milestones to make the list.
There's a unit called the Most Dangerous Offenders Project. They're on call 24 hours a day responding to homicides and attempted homicides. They responded to 135 calls this year where they went directly to crime scenes, which is a huge and unfortunate number of violence in our community. As a result, we filed 62 murder and manslaughter charges.
One of the big victories for the office came from this past legislative session.
It passed Senate Bill 5183, which made Washington State the first in the nation to provide nurse examiners to domestic violence victims of strangulation.
And that matters because
these nurses can help collect the evidence to prove strangulation happened.
It's been a historically violent year, especially with shootings.
Our quarterly shots fired reports continued to analyze the numbers of gun violence in our community at a time where we're seeing a rise in gun violence. It helps us see who's most at risk, which communities are experiencing the most impact, and ultimately how we can best target prevention and intervention strategies to end future violence.
They also saw a lot of success with one particular diversion program.
Every single month in King County, we celebrated a new class of King County Drug Diversion Court graduates.
Another source of pride?
Our team helped recover 431 firearms from an individual in a domestic violence relationship, and that can really help prevent future tragedies.
They've also stepped up efforts to protect seniors.
24 elder abuse cases filed King County by our office in 2021, including one individual who had 13 cases associated with him who targeted multiple senior men and women in a car scam.
Wagoner says they also boosted their efforts cracking down on street racing crimes.
As part of that task force earlier this year, we also announced the arrest and charging of an individual who was organizing multiple racing events, one of which resulted in the death of two young women.
And the prosecutor's office has prioritized the fight against fentanyl.
At a time where we're seeing a record number of fentanyl-related overdose, we charged multiple drug dealers, including individuals we charged of controlled substance homicide, which is when we can connect a drug dealer to individuals who actually died from overdose.
And on the issues of drugs and the need for treatment,
urging the Washington State Legislature to invest in substance use treatment.
Wagoner says they also were quick to respond to the state Supreme Court's Blake decision,
which made simple drug possession charges unconstitutional, and we immediately quashed 600 outstanding possession warrants so that folks wouldn't be rearrested on these charges.
Another notable area?
We filed 35 charges against individuals for internet crimes against children.
And beyond all of that,
every single day, our office files roughly 25 felony cases, and these are really the highest level crimes, the most serious and extreme crimes that we see in King County. And
final feather in the cap is an effort to be more transparent and accessible by increasing connections with the media.
To answer your questions and through those questions, get the public information about what's going on with their criminal justice system in King County.
Those are the 21 milestones of the prosecutor's office for 2021. Looking ahead to 2022, you can expect much more as the prosecutor's office looks to focus on a victim-centered approach with a push for a victim's bill of rights. And on top of all of that, The King County Prosecutor's Office will also take the first Washington law enforcement officer to be charged with murder under I-940 to trial when Auburn Police Officer Jeff Nelson goes on trial for the murder of Jesse Saray. A status hearing on that trial expected next month.
Colorado's Hannah Scott.
A mom started a nonprofit to spread kindness and create amazing days for others. CBS's Steve Hartman has your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
A soldier surprising her family after months apart. But our story isn't about this reunion. It's about the woman who made it possible. Maddie Mitchell is the unseen hand behind an untold number of joyful surprises here in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hey, babe.
This stay-at-home mother of two, with a third on the way, got started making other people's days after her worst day. A fourth child, Liam, a preemie, died at just 6 weeks.
I felt like my son can't just come in this world just to suffer and then die.
He found his purpose.
Mm-hmm. And it's helped so many kids.
How many good deeds has your group done?
Hundreds.
Hundreds?
Maddie started a nonprofit called Liam Changed the World. And in the 10 years since, he has.
We pay medical bills for children.
From planning a parade for a kid with cancer to collecting supplies for flood victims. If kindness is needed, Liam's mom is there. Her most recent effort? To help Army Private First Class Harmony Jackson surprise her family.
I love you.
Harmony hadn't seen her kids in person.
I said I love you.
In 7 months. Maddie found Harmony on Facebook and offered to orchestrate the reunion. She lured the dad, telling him he'd want a photo shoot for the family.
Oh, sweet.
Then showered them with gifts. And finally,
thank you.
The ultimate present. Of course, for Maddie, the moment was tinged with irony. A hug like this is something she and Liam will never know. But Maddie insists that every good deed she does reunites her, too.
I feel my son, because I always say that's him doing that from heaven, that he's still working his purpose from up there.
Look. Nice work, Liam.
Jeez.
You're raising a great mom.
Thank you so much.
I just want to do good.
Steve Hartman.
Mission accomplished.
On the road.
Thank you.
In Nashville, Tennessee.
Love it when people take such difficult situations and turn it into something positive.
Yeah. 7:48, and that's time for G. Scott, visiting from the G. and Ursula Show, and this is like a must-win game.
This is definitely a must-win game. If, as a matter of fact, the Seahawks need all the help in the world. First and foremost, they have four games left to play. Yes, they do play tonight, Dave. And, of course, then they come back and play again on Sunday. So we already know it's a short week, and they had to go travel, right? So they have to win this game against the Rams, and they have to come home and win against the Bears, and then they have to win against the Detroit Lions, and then they have to win against the Arizona Cardinals. So they got to win all four of those games and still need help from other people. Yeah. So when we saw the Saints beat the Tampa Bay Buccaneers the other day, that was not good. That was not good. So now we need the Saints. We need to win all these games, and we need the Saints to lose two out of their next three, and we need some more help as well.
Okay, explain the eligibility rules. The COVID protocol, as you predicted, has changed. So now it's not about just testing positive, but whether you have any symptoms, right?
Yes, and it is about having symptoms. And I'm going to take this time, and I got a few minutes. I'm upset with the NFL.
Again?
I'm very upset with the NFL. The NFL pivoting to less COVID testing and not more is a dangerous example to set for the country. You are showing the world, hey, if you don't have symptoms, then you can come play. So what will happen in our society when we see this? Example, if I'm exposed, you know what? I'm going to make this example really hit, and maybe Sully will pay attention and hear this one. If I'm exposed to COVID and I know it, but I don't have symptoms, Sully, would you be okay with me being around you and then you catch COVID and then you have to miss your son's national championship game because of my selfishness?
No, I would expect that if you don't have symptoms but you know you have it, that you would quarantine yourself.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But these are, no, but don't get, but Sully,
You're not going to die.
I'm going to miss my son's game. That is
But you're not going to die.
No.
You know what I mean? So
these I should point out you two are only 4 feet apart right now.
My mask is back on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I'm giving that example, guys, to say when people say, well, the death rate is only this. COVID doesn't just impact us by just, well, first of all, 827,000 Americans have died in this country. That should be enough. But it's not just death. It's things like missing a funeral, a wedding, a national championship game, which Tommy's going to be playing in on January 8th. It's all of these things that happen. So when the NFL basically says to the country, Dave, hey, as long as you don't have symptoms, you can come out here and play. And that right there is going to be followed by a lot of folks.
I hate to be cynical, but is it all about the money?
What? What?
Oh, what? Come on. You're all thinking it.
What? I just said this to Dave Ross.
You're all thinking it.
I said this to Dave Ross yesterday. We are far more committed to capitalism than democracy, justice, and the welfare of people. This continues to happen. There's money and everything. I can go on and on.
Well, but what more can be said? People who know what the rules of the game are, and the people who have been cynical about the vaccines have been saying all along, hey, the vaccine's no perfect protection. So the left knows what the truth is, the right knows what the truth is, and conduct yourselves accordingly. We now know that you can be fully vaccinated and boosted and still carry the virus and pass on the virus. What more do you need to know? Wear your mask if you don't want to infect somebody who's unvaccinated. And there are some people who got vaccinated and boosted, and even though they say that you won't go to the hospital, they end up in the hospital. So there's a risk to taking a bath. I mean, you know, I was reading what the relative risks are, and you're still at risk, you know, slipping and killing yourself in your bathtub. So be careful. What can I say?
You're absolutely right. There's risk to everything. But I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you what you don't want to feel. I'll tell you what risk you don't want. You don't want to have a cousin pass away of COVID.
Yeah.
And you never were able to go and see, be a part of that funeral because nobody was allowed in. You never want that to happen. And accidents and life, they don't make appointments. Hey, just so you know, I'm going to reach out to you and really make life hard for you on December 21st of 2021. That's not how life works. And so you're right, Dave. There's a risk in all of this. And the best that everyone can do is do the best for themselves and their loved ones and do the best possible. I think we're too late in the game to tell people if it's real or what you should do and all that stuff. And I think you're right. But my one last thing I want to say is this. Our celebrities and our sports figures, they get paid a lot of money to endorse products. We are people, we will go and use those products because that person endorses that product. And so where we might say, Charles Barkley says, yeah, I'm not your role model. Yeah, you're not. We should be the parents. It should be the family. But the truth is sometimes my own sons, and I'm a dad, my own sons will listen to something that Russell Wilson said on TV, and I've told them that 100 times, but they act like that was the first time they ever heard it because Russell Wilson said it.
One more thing. Who's going to win?
Seahawks, baby.
All right.
Yeah. Seahawks going to win. Seahawks going to win. They're going to win 27-13.
27-13.
Book it.
Take it to the back.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.